See, I like the squatty potty is sort of destigmatizing talking about poop.
Hello and welcome to the Intelligent Millennials podcast, where we got nothing figured out but everything to say. The goal of this show is to have intelligent conversations with our guests, have fun, and hopefully drop a little bit of knowledge in the process. My name is Viet Nguyen. I'm the owner of the Intelligent Millennials blog, and today I'm also the host of the Intelligent Millennials podcast. You can find me on Twitter under the handle at @VietPDX. This is the third episode of a planned pilot season where I'm going to be interviewing friends and listening to their stories. I'll be talking to Jessica Busho, who is a friend of mine and probably top 20 when it comes to the most healthy, active people I know. Last year, however, she was diagnosed with stage 4 colorectal cancer. So today we'll be catching up on life, running, volunteering, early 2000s emo music, and being outdoors. We then talk about her cancer diagnosis and how she's had to adjust her life. Cancer is a very difficult subject to talk about, especially when you or someone you know gets diagnosed with it. If you're diagnosed, how do you go about telling your friends? What kind of help should you be asking for? How do you explain all this to your young kids? For myself personally, it had been an incredibly difficult subject to approach. My mother passed away from cancer in 2010, and only recently have I been able to be more open about talking about her experience and also my experience. Talking about cancer simply sucks all the air out of the room and can make conversations extremely awkward. Many people avoid talking about their own cancer because they don't want to feel pitied, nor do they want to be viewed as simply a host of cancer. And for friends of people with cancer, it's equally difficult to maneuver. You might want to offer condolences or sympathy, but then it might come off as trite or insincere. It might even sound like you're more interested in the cancer than the person, which plays exactly into what the patient is afraid of. If you avoid talking about cancer, then it becomes an 800-pound gorilla and you risk coming off like you don't care about the patient's well-being at all. So where can we strike a good balance, and how can we support our loved ones if a family member gets diagnosed? Please join our conversation as we talk about all of these things. So I'm going to get right into it and start with the icebreaker questions. Is that okay?
Okay.
Okay, what's the last thing you Googled?
Oh, HDMI to VGA conversion.
Why did you do that?
I was trying to get my laptop that doesn't have the right kind of cable to hook up to my projector and trying to figure out which cords I needed, and everything doesn't go together, but it worked out fine anyway. Got it all figured out.
What's on your Spotify or your Apple Music playlist?
Okay, so this is going to make you laugh so hard because you and I went to college together, but Dashboard Confessional just came out with a new album.
Yes.
Yeah, so I'm just starting to listen to it, and I'm excited. I don't know any of the songs really well yet, but I like it a lot. I like his other project better. It's called Twin Forks, but they don't tour as much, so I'm going to jump on board with going back to Dashboard Confessional for now.
You know what's funny? The older I get, the more I realize that fans kind of age with the band. So like the same people who like Dashboard Confessional like 10 years ago are like the same people now. So like if you go to a Dashboard Confessional concert, it's a bunch of 30-year-olds. Or like Backstreet Boys, it's a bunch of like 30-year-olds.
Actually, you know what's really funny is my husband and I went to the Dashboard Confessional and Third Eye Blind concert in San Francisco, I don't know, like maybe 4 years ago. Everyone there was not only my age, but I ran into a bunch of people who I went to high school and college with. It was definitely a specific age crowd.
And I don't know how to feel about that, if I'm supposed to be embarrassed or I don't know. It just is. I'm not going to be ashamed that I like listening to like Dashboard Confessional and stuff.
I was actually supposed to go to a Twin Forks concert last year, and I got diagnosed with cancer, and I had my first chemo 4 days before the concert was supposed to happen, and they really freak you out about how immune compromised you'll be, so I decided not to go. So I'm due for a Chris Caraba project.
You got to start listening to the music then, because, you know, every time you go to a DC concert, you have to, it's basically like karaoke. Like, you almost don't even hear the guy sing. It's just like the entire crowd. And then, like, I had my phone with me to record. I always make the same mistake. I always, like, I'm going to record this so I could, like, listen to it later, like, on my phone. It never sounds, it never sounds like it does at the concert. And then on top of that, all you hear is just a bunch of girls, like, singing along. So it's like, yeah, okay.
I know. I don't know how live albums ever sound good, because when you're there, all same thing. All you hear is all the people.
Okay, next question. What have you been watching on Netflix?
If I had to pick something, if we have like a Friday night and nothing to do, we love to look on Hulu or Amazon for like documentaries about outdoorsy stuff. I watched one not too long ago called Meru, which was about these guys trying to summit a peak near like in India.
Okay. What's something you think that is overrated?
I think having a lot of money or a lot of possessions. I mean, we have a house that's nice and all that, but we don't drive like a super fancy car, you know, and I think we'd rather have experiences. And you'd be surprised how easy it is with kids. Like, there's a lot of pressure on parents to feel like you have to buy everything because someone else has it. You know, like my kids came home and they're like, oh, we need the new Xbox. And I'm like, what are you going to play on it? And they're like, we don't know. Okay. And you don't need it, you know? So, and that we really don't, we don't have time for video games. We're too busy doing other fun stuff.
Speaking of possessions, what's the best purchase that you've made that's under $100 in the past 6 months?
That one is really easy. It's a National Parks pass. It's only $80, actually. So you can use your 20 for something else.
You get Chipotle or something. Yeah.
That sounds good, and take it with you to all the national parks. I can't believe it's only $80. Every time we renew it, I'm like, this has got to be crazy, but you can go to all these places for $80 for a whole year. And actually, next year, we don't even have to pay for it because my son's going to be in fourth grade, and when your kid's in fourth grade, then you get a free family pass for the year.
Is that like in Brentwood that they have just a school district, or is that for like all kids? I'm not in California anymore, so I don't know.
I'm probably wrong about this, but I think that Michelle Obama, part of her initiative that she did to try and get kids to be more active, they started this program for fourth graders all over the country. So you just go onto the National Park Service government website and your kid plays like a little game, and then they put in their age, and then you print it out and you bring it to your closest national park, and then they give them a card and they have it for the whole year.
Oh, wow. So that's like not just $100. That's like 100 times like 5, right? For the whole family. So you just made off there.
No, because the $80 pass is for your whole family. That's the crazy thing.
Okay. Yeah, that is a pretty good deal.
It's a really good deal. That's definitely the best purchase that I would make. I can't think of anything else that you could get for or do that many things for that much money, you know?
Even going to see like a movie for you guys, that's like $50 or $60 right there, huh? So instead of that, you could go to the park.
Yes.
Okay, so let's get on to the meatier part of the interview. So out of all the people I know, you're probably like top 20 as far as the most active. This started at an early age. So in high school, you mentioned that you went backpacking across the Sierra Nevadas.
I think when I was like in third grade, we started backpacking and we would just do little short treks. And sort of the culmination of that was when I was 14, my dad and my sister and I went with my friend Tracy and her family. And we started on the west side of the Sierras, just a little ways outside of Fresno. And it's called the High Sierra Trail. And you backpack from really where the big trees are, like the sequoia trees down there. And you backpack for, let's see, it took us 11 days on the trail. Only 9 of those were hiking. We had a couple rest days. And I think it was about 90 miles, and you go up to Mount Whitney. Unfortunately, when we were there, there was a lightning storm, so we didn't get to summit Mount Whitney, but that is definitely an item that I would like to come back around to and get to go back there. But that was a great experience and definitely saw a lot of things and discover yourself when you're hiking all day, every day with, let's see, at the time I weighed about 90 pounds and I carried a pack that was like 45 to 47 pounds, something like that.
I have never gone backpacking. Like, I've gone camping before. I've gone hiking before, but never both. Like, what do you put in your backpack that would last like 11 days?
So a lot of dehydrated food, and you have, you know, everything is built for backpacking. It's ultralight. So you have tent, sleeping pad, sleeping bag, very few changes of clothes, which means you don't smell great by the end of it. A water purification system, so you purify water as you go. And then a bear barrel and, you know, lots of emergency equipment and rain gear. It does rain in the afternoons a lot when you're at altitude. Yeah, I think that's the main stuff. I'm sure I'm leaving off things that people are going to say, hey, you forgot, you know, knife and all that kind of stuff. But that's part of the normal essentials.
What is something that people pack too much of if they're like new?
We've been on trips where I see people with like bread and cheese, and it's crazy because that stuff is so heavy, you know, so that would be one thing. And then the other thing is just too many clothes, because you really only need two daytime outfits, because you can wear one and then the other one can be, you can wash it in like a creek or something, and then it can be drying on your backpack. So you don't need to bring a ton of clothes. You do need lots of warm stuff, though. Got to be warm at night.
So some extra warm clothes, but not as many daytime clothes. And you can let your clothes air out, the ones you don't wear, so they're not quite as stinky.
Yes. It's just going to be part of the reality of it.
You went right before high school, so the next challenge was high school. How did that shape your attitude towards taking on challenges, especially in crazy environments such as Pioneer High?
In high school, I definitely kind of kept my head down and stuck with what I knew best, you know, which I think is something that I still do as an adult. I mean, I like to branch out and try other things a little bit, but I think being able to identify what your skill set is and use those strengths is also a good thing to do, too. Pioneer High School was rough at times, but I think that I had such a good group of friends that I think looking back, I realized how rough it was. But at the time, I think I was just having a great time.
And of course, through all of this, you are a very avid runner. If you don't mind me asking, in your heyday, how many miles did you run per week?
I was trying to think about this. I think like 60 to 80 miles a week.
Holy moly.
And that was in high school, you know, and part of that is because we're just running and chatting every day after school and then running on the weekends. And that's during summer conditioning. We would do special 24-hour running events, too, where we would run more than that. But as an adult, I did train for a half marathon. And I never really do anything halfway. You know, if I'm going to do it, I want to fully commit to it. And at that time, I was running about 50 miles a week, and that's really the highest I've ever gotten for an adult. But that was a lot just to manage my time, because I had to get up and run at 5:45 in the morning and then, you know, be ready back home so that my husband could take off and go to work and I could be back home with our kids.
So I'm going to be running a half marathon this summer. So any tips for if you have 3 months to train?
Yeah, so if you don't have a running base, there's great programs like the Couch to 5K, and I think they even have like an app. But I think the main thing would be to just build your distance gradually and don't forget to cross train, because running only builds running muscles, and if you keep only using those muscles, you're bound for injury if you don't strengthen everything else. That's sort of been my Achilles heel over the years, is I run and forget to cross train and then get injured and have to take time off, and then run and forget to cross train and get injured and have to take time off over and over.
Yeah, I've done some reading about that. Like, I think one of the number one tip was like, number one, don't get hurt, because let's say you have 3 months like me and then I get hurt like halfway in and then I have to wait like 3 weeks before I train again. Then I have like a month to catch up and now I'm behind.
And remember, when you're running, you can do anything for 10 minutes. So all you have to do is take it 10 minutes at a time.
You also mentioned that you were a bandit volunteer. What is a bandit volunteer?
A bandit runner is somebody who goes to a race and runs a race without signing up. They call them a bandit. And that's kind of a term in the running community. And there's a pretty famous ultra runner named Dean Karnauskas, who's from Northern California and has written a few books about running ultra marathons. And he talks about being a bandit runner. My husband and I actually went once to one of his running events to run it. We were going to run just the 5K on Sunday, but we decided to go check out and see what the field was like to watch the ultra runners the day before on Saturday. And these are people who are running a 50-mile race or 100-mile race. We're just out there cheering people on, and we realized there's an aid station that nobody showed up to right by where we were standing. And we kind of got out the supplies and started handing people water. And so, you know, we started this volunteer aid station without really any permission. And sure enough, we're standing there, and Dean Karnauskas, my running icon, runs up and he's like, "Hey, what are you guys doing?" And I was like, "Oh, we're starting this aid station. We're bandit volunteers." And he kind of laughed about it. And then the next day I ran the 5K and I did really well and actually ended up winning that race. And I went up to get my award and he said, "Oh, hey, the bandit volunteer." So I thought that was great. He remembered me, and that was my little 15 seconds of fame.
I think I know who he is. He's the guy who like would run the entire like actual marathon in like Greece, but like barefoot, eating nothing but like figs and stuff, right? Is that the same guy?
He does lots of crazy stuff, so that would not surprise me if he ran barefoot. And he is Greek, so that makes sense.
Yeah, he said that, you know, going to the bathroom becomes a thing when you're running for so long. And he said eating so many figs, running barefoot in Greece, and that's all you had, like, that does a number to you, too.
Yeah, his writing is really inspirational. I recommend his books to anybody.
Just on a random tangent, where we live, we have the Hood to Coast, where it's like a 200-mile relay, where, you know, there's like a team of like 12, and you do basically like a 10K, and then you hand the baton over, and you just keep doing that till you get to the beach. He did something like that by himself because he couldn't find 12 people to go with him or whatever.
I had signed up to do a race like that, and I think it was the same one that he did down here in the Bay Area, but I broke your number one runner rule, and I got injured.
So this is my second time doing the Hood to Coast, so I'm pretty excited about that. And it's been cold, and I know that's not an excuse because I see people like running around in the snow, but like I need to get back onto that.
Yeah, I wouldn't run in the snow. That's why they made treadmills.
The thing about running, at least at my level, and I'm sure at your level too, no one's there to like beat you. Everyone's just trying to beat the course. You know, I'm not like in super shape, but like no one's going to get on me for that. They're like, "Well, it's cool that you're out."
No, the running community is amazing. Everyone is so nice.
And of course, you've been happily married for many years now, and now you're basically a super mom. That must not be easy. Describe a normal week for me.
A year ago, I rarely spent time at home. I was room mom for all three of my kids' classes. Unfortunately, art in our school district is not paid for, so the parents teach art, and it's called an art docent. So I was also the art docent for their classes and volunteered about 10 hours a week in, you know, just regular classroom volunteer positions. And I was also substitute teaching at the school. So I was at the school a lot. Besides that, my afternoons were spent bringing my kids to various activities, depending on what sports season it is or what day of the week. And my kids are heavily involved in scouts. So we have, you know, Girl Scouts one day and Cub Scouts another day and Cub Scouts again, because I have two boys. And then they have classes at church. And then on the weekends, we always try and do fun stuff as a family. So we try and go places as much as possible. So over the last year, I've had to scale back quite a bit, and it's been a relief, but also a major adjustment.
Sounds like your calendar was pretty full. Tell me what happened on the days leading up to your cancer diagnosis.
I was diagnosed in April, and really I had not been feeling great since October of the previous year. I've been anemic since I was a child, and I think I was about 12 years old the first time I was diagnosed with anemia, and I've kind of had it on and off over the years. So I saw my primary care physician, and she said, oh, just increase the amount of iron you're taking and make sure that you're eating well and all that. And I've been a vegetarian for a long time, so, you know, we talked about just different dietary things that I can do with what I do eat in my diet. I always try and take care of things naturally if possible. Like, I'd rather eat a food that is iron rich than take an iron pill. But I got pretty desperate because I was feeling so weak and my hemoglobin levels were falling quite significantly. Even as I took more iron, it kept going down and I was really tired. And then I developed pica, which, if you're not familiar with that, it's the sensation that you want to eat non-food items. Fortunately for me, I'm mentally stable enough to not have acted on it, but I was craving dirt and ice, and I love the smell of fresh copy paper. I remember saying to a friend, like, oh, I love the smell of copies, and she was like, Jessica, that's not normal. And I was like, what, everyone doesn't feel that way?
Like, everyone's eating these Tide Pods or whatever.
Yes. She just looked at me blankly, and she was like, no. And I just was so oblivious. So in January, I had really severe, sharp stomach pain one day, just doubling over, which is a lot for me because I'm a pretty pain-tolerant person. So I made note of it, decided not to go to the emergency room, and I had a Girl Scout leader meeting that night. So I went to the leader meeting in enough pain that I had to shuffle my way in there, and then sat there for a couple hours and shuffled my way out. And the next day, decided to go see my same primary care physician, and brought all my supplements with me because I thought I must be having some sort of toxicity from taking too much iron, and went over it with her, and she said, no, it's fine. You can keep doing it. And I just thought, this isn't right. I'm taking six times the amount of iron that most people are taking. I don't think this is right. So I told her I was going to go off of all the supplements and I wanted to redo blood labs in a month. And she said, yes, okay, that's fine. But right now you're going to have an ultrasound. So I went and had an ultrasound and they didn't see anything. And so I went off of all the supplements and I kept getting more and more tired, and I was, you know, really exhausted. I would get winded going up my stairs and lots of stuff. And then unfortunately my middle son got really sick in February, and we spent quite a lot of time in the emergency room and dealing with that. And so my health kind of got put on the back burner. So that's just fairly typical, I think, for a lot of moms or women in general, is that you forget to prioritize yourself. So as he got better, I, you know, started really noticing how tired I was. And ironically, we were on a trip to Death Valley, and we went on a 4-mile hike, and I really could barely do the hike, which was unusual for me. My husband was like, this is not right. This is not good. When we get home, you need to go do those labs. So we went home, and it had been, you know, over a month off of vitamins, and I had labs drawn. And that night, I got a phone call in the middle of the night, and they call you, and it's like this panic, and they're like, you are in danger of dying right now. You need to go get a blood transfusion immediately. And they call you like you should be dead already. I mean, the call is really intense. And I was like, well, I don't know if I want a blood transfusion. They're like, you have to. You're going to go into heart failure. It was pretty intense. So this is just my personality, but Justin was up and getting ready for work by the time I finished this phone conversation. And I said, no, just go to work. I'll just drive myself to the ER and see if I can take care of it. And so I go to the hospital, and instead of walking straight into the ER, I went to the doctor's office and just saw whatever doctor was available, not my normal primary care doctor. And the doctor looked at me and he goes, you should not even be walking around. I was very, very sick, but my body had learned to manage it over a long period of time. long story short, I ended up with a blood transfusion that day, and then a plan for follow-ups from that day until, and that was the end of March, until the middle of April. I was having lots of tests, and I had, like I said, the blood transfusion and iron infusions, and we were just trying to figure out how to get a hold on my health. And I was having this crazy chest pressure and went for a CT scan because this new doctor thought, well, maybe you have a pulmonary embolism that's stopping you from being able to breathe or causing the chest pressure. So I went in for the CT, and at the time I should have known immediately that something was wrong because the CT staff asked me immediately if I had a history of disease in my lungs. And I said, no history of disease. And I didn't really think anything of it. And then my phone rang and my doctor said, looks like you have metastatic disease in your lungs. And it took me a second to sort of like catch my breath because it's kind of a weird thing to be told over the phone. But what he explained to me was that we're suspecting that it's cancer and that we call it cancer of unknown primary, which means it looks like you have disease that spread from somewhere else and we need to find out where it started. So he told me quickly over the phone so that I could get ready scheduling for the next day and start drinking a lot of water because the tests are really hard on your body, so you have to flush all the iodine out. That part was quite a whirlwind, but it was also a relief to find out what was wrong with me after all that time of feeling terrible.
At this point, you still don't know if it's cancer or not. They're thinking it is. They find out that it is colorectal cancer and that it's stage 4. For those who might not understand what the stages are, can you explain to me exactly what stage 4 means?
Stage 4 means that your cancer has spread to distant organs. And they stage cancer from stage 1 to stage 4. Stage 4 is the worst it gets. Stage 1 just means local cancer, and then it gradually goes up through stage 2 and stage 3 and stage 4. So for me, that meant that I had colorectal cancer and that my metastasis are in my lungs. And I also had metastatic lymph node in my neck.
You get this news from your doctor. Was it just you at that point? Was your husband still at work?
I was still sitting in the CT waiting room in my hospital gown when I got the phone call from him. It was pretty surreal. I think that the CT techs didn't know what to do. They hadn't released me yet because they could see immediately how bad it was. I had 17 tumors in my lungs. So yeah, my husband was at work, and then actually, you know what? He was at baseball practice with our kids. I walked out of the hospital and I called my cousin who lives in town and is my best friend. I talked to her every day, and so I had to process it, and I could have been more gentle in hindsight, you know, with how I told her and how I told my closest circle of friends. I think my doctor had been so blunt with me that I had no experience with that before. I've been fortunate enough. I've had family members that have had cancer, but not immediate family members. So I didn't know how you tell people that kind of news. So I just did it the same way he did with me, which was maybe not the most gentle way.
What did you say? You say just, I have cancer?
Exactly. It's like, answer the phone. And I said, am I on speaker? They said, no. And I said, I have cancer.
And then there was an awkward pause after that.
I think the friends that were closest to me knew how terrible I had been feeling and that I had had all these weird sensations to eat things that I shouldn't and that I was weak and that I wasn't saying yes to things I would normally want to do with them. They had seen my health sort of decline without knowing what it was. So I don't think I think they were shocked, but not shocked that it was something, just shocked that it had to be cancer.
So how did you explain to your kids? I got this news from my mom when I was like a senior in high school, and I don't recall how I took it, but I can imagine what my mom had to go through and to come up with the right kind of words to explain things to your family. That I think, and you could correct me if I'm wrong, but like you take the news, it's horrible, but now you have to turn around and explain to the people who are closest to you. So you mentioned your cousin, but now you had to break the news to your husband and also to your kids. Your kids are still pretty young, so it's already a pretty sensitive subject there. So how did you do it?
Everyone had suspected GI cancer or colorectal cancer because of my stomach pain in January. So I had to have a colonoscopy to confirm that. So I had a CT on a Thursday, another CT on Friday to confirm the metastatic disease. And then I had the colonoscopy on Monday. So within 4 days, we had found out that I did, in fact, have colon cancer, which we wanted to find out that first before we said anything. Now, at this point, we had told maybe our 5 closest friends and our parents, my husband's parents and my parents, and really nobody else. I had asked friends to keep us in their thoughts and prayers so people knew that we were facing some sort of challenge. But at that point, we realized we needed to tell our kids because people around them knew and we didn't want them to find out from anyone else. So we just sat them down and explained that I had cancer. And it is hard that they're young, but I think that it's also good that they're young because they didn't have a lot of knowledge of what cancer is. We've had family members around us with cancer, but nobody in our immediate family. So they hadn't had any negative experiences with anyone close to them having cancer or having passed away from cancer. And I'm so sorry, you know, that you've had that experience. I think we just gave them, you know, a child-sized dose of information, and we still continue to take that approach. We had lots of people reach out and give us gifts for the kids and books about when parents have cancer or when grandma has cancer or whatever. But a lot of those books are really terrifying if you read them. I mean, they talk about cancer as if it becomes the whole person. And we wanted to make it really clear to our kids and to all our friends that this is just part of a challenge for us. It doesn't become my identity and it won't become our family's identity. My kids just see me as a really resilient person. So I think we told them I had cancer, and then I can't remember what it was, but they asked a question right after, like, okay, but what are we having for dinner? You know, like, they just, kids are so resilient, and they obviously don't understand the gravity of what stage 4 colon cancer means. So that was a huge blessing for us, for them to not understand that and just see my strength, and they made me see my own strength.
We're now at day 1. You just broke the news to your family. What's the game plan after that diagnosis and after you've told your family?
I had one friend who had recently been diagnosed with a different type of cancer. So I reached out to her and sort of asked what would be the time frame. And she said it'll move really fast. And she was right. It moved really fast from the time of my initial CT scan, which wasn't even an official diagnosis, until my very first chemo was less than 3 weeks. Over that time, I had the colonoscopy that I mentioned, which is where they take a picture of the inside of your intestines, and they took biopsies, and they, you know, look at the tumor and all kinds of stuff. And then I had a port put in, which is a device that they put in for chemotherapy so that you don't have to get it in your arm. Because with colon cancer, the chemotherapy is delivered over a 46-hour period, so you go home and sleep with it and everything. So they get you all tapped into this port for every time you have chemotherapy. Those 20 days were full of that, and then I met with one oncologist who was, you know, I'm sure she's very lovely for some people, but not my cup of tea. So then I met with another oncologist and another oncologist. I was very persistent, and then I was really lucky to have a friend reach out who said, my husband works in oncology and he just wants to, you know, lend his advice if you ever need it. And we were getting to a point where we felt a little desperate because I hadn't found an oncologist that I felt really confident about yet. My friend's husband wasn't going to be able to treat me, but he might have some insight. So I contacted him. And he got me in contact with a couple of great oncologists who specialize in colon cancer within our health network. So we're part of Kaiser, which is kind of a big HMO. I met with a whole bunch of oncologists in that first short amount of time and then got started with chemo within 20 days.
What were you looking for in an oncologist?
I was looking for someone that I felt confident in, that I felt like had the most cutting edge information and that was going to be aggressive with me. And I was also looking for someone who I clicked with, who I liked their personality, and that I felt like, you know, would be tolerant of my questions and my persistence, because I knew that I was going to face this thing head on. And the first couple oncologists, one of my biggest struggles with them was that they didn't see my age as the benefit that I believe that it is. Colon cancer is historically a disease that occurs in the older population, right? So the statistics that are out there and the treatments that are out there and the standard of care that are out there and have been practiced for years are based on the 50-year and older age group. Being that I was 33 when I was diagnosed, my tolerance for chemotherapy and my tolerance for surgery or any other sort of treatment, I felt personally would be much higher based on age alone. Not that there aren't some amazing older adults out there, but, you know, your body is just more adaptable at a young age, I think. So I really wanted to find a doctor who would see my age as an advantage, who would be aggressive with me but not reckless, and who just had a great personality. And eventually the doctor that I did find, I knew before I even talked to him, because I walked into his room and the walls are plastered with inspirational quotes and funny comic strips and things that, you know, instead of it being a room with just one poster on the wall about where to get a free wig for chemotherapy patients, that just makes you think about your cancer and you're sitting there in a panic anyway. He had all these things to distract me and to make me feel inspired and hopeful.
So it sounds like you took on this head on. You were basically, you know, give me the strongest form possible.
Yes, and I maybe in the beginning overestimated how much I thought I could do, because I had a strong intuition that I wanted to have surgery right away, and that is not the standard of care for advanced colon cancer, because it's a very slow growing cancer. So the norm is to have chemotherapy and get everything under control and then possibly have surgery if you're able to tolerate it. I was asking for a doctor that would do surgery, and eventually I was told, if any doctor will tell you they'll do surgery at the beginning without doing chemotherapy, then they're not a good doctor. I went to enough oncologists to finally find out and feel confident in the course of action that we were taking, and yeah, decided to go full bore on the strongest chemotherapy that they wanted to give me, and yeah, just face it the best I could. Even I had an allergic reaction at my fifth chemotherapy. One of the chemos is a platinum derivative, so it's really, really hard on your body. And my oncologist knew that I could tolerate more of it if he could just find a way to make my body be tricked into keeping taking it. So he decided to slow it down. And the nurses were like, well, we're going to be here all night if we slow it down that much. And he said, okay, then you're here all night, you know, and not that he was unsympathetic, but he put my survival as the priority. And that drug is really the best drug out there on the market. And you should take it as long as you possibly can.
So tell me about how it feels like the day after chemo.
With colon cancer, you have the chemotherapy pump for 46 hours. And when you get your first chemo infusion, you know, in clinic, in the chair, they give you two of the drugs in the clinic. They also give you a steroid that's an anti-anemic. It's to help you with nausea and vomiting. But for me, because I'm already an energetic person and I'm small and I haven't taken a lot of medicine in my life, all the medication works really great on me, including steroids. So the day I would have chemo and the days immediately following chemo, I felt like a superhero. And I always had to find something to clean or something to do or some sort of project to keep myself busy, because the steroids really just hype you up. Eventually, I think after 3 or 4 rounds of that and feeling that hyper, I decided to stop taking the steroid, and I never had a problem with nausea, so I really didn't need it. With the approval of my doctor, everything I did, you know, I definitely led the way, but, you know, making sure that everything that I was doing was with doctor's approval. So then I would start to feel the chemo let down, you know. So you go into chemo, and by the time I would leave the chair, because I would sit there for 6 hours, I would feel tired, just like I've been awake for too long, and go home and be tired. And then the next day, it's just like, it's kind of like having a hangover and having the flu, or for women who have had kids, it's like first trimester pregnancy and being really tired, and just all at once, just like low level nausea and the world kind of spinning, but you got to keep going.
Did you have to make any adjustments to your diet?
When I first was diagnosed, I was convinced I was going to go on an all-protein diet, which is really hard for a vegetarian to do. When I had, you have something called a PET scan. It's a type of scan that they do to see how active the cancer is in your body. They inject you with radioactive sugar, although there's no scientific or conclusive evidence that says that sugar feeds cancer. The fact that they injected me with radioactive sugar to see where my cancer was in my body was enough for me to say I wanted to go on a low sugar diet. I cut out all sugar from my diet and all simple carbs that basically would convert to sugar. And I was eating like a really high protein, high plant-based fat diet, and then as many veggies as possible. And I did lots of research on what are the best foods for fighting cancer, and started eating turmeric and cruciferous vegetables and lots of kale and things like that. Now I have realized it's not sustainable, so I just try to eat the healthiest that I can every single day. And a big part of my journey has been realizing that I was pretty obsessive about everything I did. Like, years ago, I heard that about organic food, and so I became, you know, obsessed with making sure our family only ate organic. I've made a lot of like fear-based decisions in my life and been kind of extreme about things. So part of my healing process has been to change that part of my approach to life, because there's also a lot of belief in other cultures. And I mean, and I think a lot of people in Western culture too, that cancer or disease like that originates from energy that's maybe channeled in the wrong way or held in your body in the wrong way. And so I did some research about colon and lungs and found out that where I was holding my energy had a lot to do with my need to control everything or make, you know, these fear-based decisions. So I'm learning to not be so extreme about everything and to be just a little more flexible.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. Obviously, there's a lot of woo-woo stuff out there, but in terms of broad strokes, my mom had a lot of stress when she was alive, you know, during work or whatever, and I'm sure that didn't contribute to her health. So I'd imagine if you just either didn't have a good attitude about something or you were holding a lot of stress in your body, whether it is a factor in causing cancer or not, I would say that it definitely doesn't help your cause.
Our bodies make mistakes all the time. So cancer like originates from a cell that was making a mistake in a replication of itself, you know, somewhere. And that you have parts of you that are supposed to see those mistakes and kill them, right? But you have to be running under ideal conditions for that to be the case. And if you're constantly stressed and you're constantly in fight or flight and you're constantly, you know, worried about everything, then that's all your body is doing. And you have stress hormones that are preventing you from being able to catch those mistakes, you know. Just like a worker on a factory line who was overworked would miss something. I think stress doesn't help your body fight those natural mistakes that happen in your daily process.
So let's pivot just a little bit to your family. I know just from my experience, people constantly asked me about how my mom was doing. And like, obviously they're like my friends, and I feel kind of jerky. I feel guilty. I'm sure you've kind of felt the same way sometimes. But I would get irritated because people would constantly ask about like, well, how's the cancer doing? How's this or how that is doing? Yeah, and obviously having the cancer itself is like a million times worse. But talk about the toll it could take on, you know, someone close to you or a friend or a family member. But they seem, it feels like the air gets sucked out of it, and now all they could talk about is cancer.
We recognized that that was a possibility in the beginning, and actually it happened quickly in the first 2 weeks or so. And in the beginning, that's all we were doing too. So everything did revolve around it. So I actually put a broad statement out on social media to ask people to see me as a person and to see my family as people and to not treat us all as victims. And then I feel that that made a big difference. But you're right. I think, and I don't think that there's a what's harder or who has it harder. In some ways, I think that the cancer caregivers or family members have it harder than the actual patient, because the patient has people around them looking at them, you know, doctors, and you have objectives and goals that you're going for and tests that measure your progress and all that. And the caregiver, their role is just solely support, basically. And there's not, they don't get a lot of attention. Not in the narcissistic needing attention way, but just making sure that they're feeling okay. Other than pity, which I don't think many people like to feel pitied. So I think that my husband and I have done a pretty good job of trying to make sure that we're each supporting each other. And I've said at times that he possibly can't understand what I'm going through. And I have also said at times that I possibly can't understand what he is going through, because they're completely different experiences. I'm dealing with the what ifs of things that I feel that I need to either prepare or do in the event that I'm not here for the entirety of my children's, you know, young lives and for my marriage. And he's dealing with how he cope with the aftermath of that. I should say I've had amazing success with my chemotherapy. And while there's no cure for stage 4 colon cancer, I believe that I will far outlive the life expectancy that they gave me.
Tell me, I'm going to say, hey, Jess, how are you doing? And you say, I got cancer. So, hey, Jess, how are you doing?
I got cancer.
And then it's just like a really awkward pause after that. And I'm not quite sure what to say. It's like, oh, well, that sucks. But like, if I say that, then it sounds like, well, it's like you just stub your toe. And like, that sounds like I'm like minimalizing it. Or like, okay, well, like, hey, Jess has cancer. I'm just going to not talk about it and pretend like she doesn't have cancer. But then it sounds like I'm a jerk. On the opposite side, if I say like, oh, how's your cancer doing? I really want to help out or whatever. Then like I'm pouring it on and it sounds like disingenuous, and I don't want to get to that either. So as someone who is a friend or family member, the question I want to get out, or the idea, is what's the best way to treat or to talk to someone who has cancer?
So I have a mix of people around me. I have people around me who only see me as cancer. And I have people around me who I'm not really sure if they even know if I have cancer, because they don't ever talk about it. And then I have some people who see me as a person, and then every once in a while I ask about it or will talk about it if I bring it up. And that's obviously like the sweet spot to be in. The funny thing is that the people who are closest to me outside of my husband and my kids, you know, close family members or close friends, I feel like those are the ones who struggle with seeing me as more than my disease. For them, I would hope that they would be able to talk to me about other things and recognize that I want to be seen as a person. There's a saying that says cancer is one page, but it's not the whole book. And I love that, because unfortunately it's a really sucky page, but there's a whole bunch more that I've done in my life. And I would like other people to see that. And then as far as it goes with my husband and my kids, I think that it's particularly hard for the kids, because I don't think that they think about it all the time. As a cancer patient, it's hard to forget that you have it, because either you're experiencing symptoms or you have, you know, scars or aches or whatever that don't let you forget about it. But honestly, I think that there are days that go by where my kids forget that I have cancer. And I think that when other people bring it up, it brings them back to that same shock as the beginning of finding out, you know, so it's nice if they can just be kids. I think if someone has young kids, like, it's, unless you're in like a counseling type setting where you're supposed to be addressing the cancer, or if the kid brings up the cancer, I don't think that it's something that should be brought up to them. And I don't think that they should be treated with a sense of like pity or depression, you know. People sometimes hug my kids for a really long time, and that kind of makes my ears feel hot. You know, that feeling where you're just mad and it's like, don't I don't want people to use my kids as a coping mechanism, and I don't want people to project their feelings about cancer onto my kids either. For my husband, he needs a mix of support, you know, and asking how he's doing and asking how I'm doing. Also just being able to be a regular person too, because same thing as being the caregiver, I think it's on his mind a lot, but I think he has moments where he's able to forget about it, and it's nice to live in those moments. I feel like at this point, we're almost a year past diagnosis, and all of us kind of live for the moments where cancer is not at the forefront of our minds, or even maybe a forgotten thing. Justin just started doing a poker game, which I think he's, you know, is a great thing to do socially, and he gets a lot of fulfillment and pride from his work, and he has great friends at work. You know, for people to value him and the things he does just the way they did before, but also be there, maybe just be a little closer and don't talk about it, but be closer.
Yeah, it's hard. That's why I wanted to bring it up, because that's like the $1 million question.
I think being more available is the big thing. The best thing that you can do for somebody is to let them know that you're there and to answer the phone, you know, if they call and they need to talk, but not bring it up all the time.
The thing with my experience, and I don't blame anybody for this, really. I get jaded from all the sympathy and the pity.
Yeah.
And I just don't want it. I don't want to hear it. It got to the point where my mom, she didn't even want to tell people she had cancer, just because, like, the second she mentions it, boom, conversation changes. And it's like, oh my gosh, we're going through this again? Like, seriously?
Yeah. I have met a few people who have, you know, earlier stage cancers, and they don't tell other people. I'm very upfront about mine for a few reasons. One is because it's not curable, and so it's like a chronic disease at this point. It's like having diabetes or heart disease or something like that, and I just have to manage it. The other reason is that colon cancer is the only cancer that is preventable, and it's preventable through screening. And so I tell people about it, because if me telling one person makes them get a colonoscopy or makes them go to their mammogram or makes them go have a prostate cancer blood test screening done, then, and it catches their cancer early, then I've done my job.
Yeah, and I think also what you're doing is you're kind of controlling the message, like you're getting out in front of it, so that you break the news and you go like, hey, I got cancer, it's stage 4, pause. Okay, let's talk about the Ashport Confessional, you know, like,
yeah.
That way they could just process it and it doesn't become an elephant in the room, and you kind of just take that for yourself instead of for having them trying to like approach it.
But I mean, that being said, I have met some people, acquaintance type people, who are super unsympathetic, and not that I'm asking for pity or anything, but unsympathetic to like the accommodations, like especially when I was actively receiving chemo, that I just wasn't able to commit to things the way that I had previously. Part of the thing about how common cancer is, you know, how many young people are being diagnosed with it, is that, and how many different types of disease there are, is that there's, you know, sort of misunderstanding or what cancer looks like. I didn't lose my hair. And for some people who are acquaintances, again, not good friends, that's translated to, you know, I'm either not doing chemotherapy or not struggling or anything like that. And I have maintained like so much of my life that I can, but there are a few things that are just a struggle to do, things that I used to normally do. For example, that same platinum-derived chemotherapy causes really bad cold sensitivity and neuropathy that is permanent. So I've had to say no to some experiences with my family that would cause me to be in a situation where I would be cold. And luckily it's subsiding a little bit. So I, you know, like we got to go to the snow this year, which I thought we would never get to do. So I'm grateful for that. But just there's some things that it's mentally hard. It's such a weird balance. Like I want people to understand that it's not easy, but I don't want them to see me as only cancer. I don't know. It's not that I want them to see that it's not easy. It's that I want them to understand that I'm doing my best.
How have your friends been able to help you out?
The best help has been the ridiculous amount of people who have helped with my kids. Having 3 kids, especially last year, I had 3 different pickup times for my kids after school. So sometimes I'd have appointments that went long, or like I said, I'd have 6 hour long chemotherapies and people have picked them up. My kids think it's been like the best thing in the world because they've had tons of play dates going over to friends' houses, sometimes unexpectedly, which is great for them. People, you know, brought us a lot of meals and great things like that. I feel like I've gotten a lot closer with a lot of my friends, and my close friends jokingly call me Jessica now, because when I was leading up to my diagnosis, when I was so tired, I said no to pretty much everything, and nobody knew why, but it was because I was just basically doing what I could to scrape by and live on my volunteer commitments and then like go home and like sit on the couch and do nothing and just like space out because I was so tired. So now I say yes to everything, and I'm not so overcommitted that I am out of time. I have gone out for lots of breakfasts and gone on hikes and gone to the park and vacations with friends and all kinds of things that have been so great. And it's good to have that. I feel like I always have an excuse to say yes to everything now.
I suppose one way a person can help out is just not, doesn't have to be anything crazy, but like taking the kids out and picking them up for this or that. If there's like Metallica is showing, then you could take Justin out to a concert or whatever. Like,
yes,
you don't have to go. Yeah, you don't have to pour out sympathies or whatever. It's just like the little tiny practical things. Is that correct?
Yeah, all of that. And some people might have mixed feelings about this, but when I was first diagnosed, I got hundreds of cards from people from my entire span of my life, from people who are elementary school teachers all the way up to friends that I have right now, from every avenue of life that I've put energy into. And it was weird at first because I was in shock of, you know, how far my diagnosis news reached, but also amazing to know that a lot of those people had me in their thoughts and prayers and, you know, were there in support if I needed them. And I think that that sort of feeling of being lifted up by everybody sure gives you strength to do anything. You know, when you know that there's all these people who are invested in you getting well, then it sure is a motivation. Besides, if having three little kids and a husband wasn't motivation enough, I have all these other friends whose lives I've touched at a different time or who have touched my life at a different time. One of my first outings that I made after having chemotherapy was to go to the store and get a big bulletin board and hung all the cards in my room. And I felt iffy about it at first because I didn't want to be reminded constantly of my cancer with the cards. But I realized very quickly that the cards are not a reminder of the cancer, but a reminder of how many amazing relationships I have. And most of them are either funny or inspirational. None of them really made me feel sad. So sending someone a card does way more than you would even ever know.
I know that you are a very devout Catholic. How has your faith helped out?
In my diagnosis, I realized very quickly that my faith would be very important to me. And ironically, it was one of our mutual friends from high school who's not a Catholic but is Mormon, Becky, to remind me that my faith is there for me to rely on it. She sent me a card and actually a copy of her book from her church, the Book of Mormon. She, you know, wasn't wanting to push her faith on me, but that she had certain scriptures that she would read during hard times, and these were ones that she thought were particularly helpful. So she had highlighted in the book a few different places. So I read them and sat and reflected on it and then flipped through the Book of Mormon because I had never seen one before. And then I kind of said to myself, why haven't I prayed about this? You know, I think it was so much shock, and like many people, I think in the beginning, it's all about me. I never really questioned my faith or God because I think some people would say, oh, why would God do this to somebody, or didn't Jesus die so that we would be forgiven? But that's never really been part of my thought process. I think my faith is what reminds me that in the end, heaven is the ultimate goal, you know, and to be in God's loving arms, and that this is only a part of our existence. I love my family here and I want to be with them as long as possible, but death is not the worst thing in the world.
I've heard a quote. I don't know exactly where it's from. I don't want to attribute it to someone. Someone's attributed it to like JFK, but I'm sure he didn't come up with it. He said, don't pray for the tribulation to go away, but pray to become a stronger person. This is going to make you stronger by the time you get out of it. The goal isn't necessarily to get the thing taken away from you.
And I think that's where faith comes in, is that if you didn't have your faith, could you make it through the trial? I don't know. Having faith has definitely let me turn my cancer diagnosis into a strength, and also helped me see that my whole life I've been faced with different challenges, and they've been preparing me for what ultimately I think right now is hopefully the biggest challenge I'll ever face, and to use all of those skills that I've developed to have strength to be able to beat this and to believe that I can beat it.
And definitely, just through your journey, you've spread so much awareness, and I'm sure your kids, maybe they might not understand it or know about it now, but probably in the future when they become adults, they're going to look back at your example and be like, wow, you know, that was a pretty strong woman.
Yeah, I sure hope so. I just want to say one other thing about my faith. When I first got diagnosed, I was telling the nun at my church, who is the faith formation director, so she leads all the children's classes, and she said, this is not your plan. God has a bigger plan for you. And she just had such a confidence about it, and she just knew. And it was immediate. It wasn't like she went home and thought about it and decided later, but she just knew right away that there's a bigger plan here. I keep telling myself that in moments of weakness, you know, or in hard moments, that there's a bigger plan here.
So where are you right now as far as your cancer is concerned?
So in January, I transitioned to UCSF to be able to be seen by what I believe to be the best colon cancer doctor in the world, and what a lot of people believe to be the best colon cancer doctor in the world. Like I said before, the cancer has responded really well to chemotherapy, so much so that it made me a candidate for surgery. So I worked with him and we coordinated surgeries, and I had a bowel resection, which is where they cut out part of your large intestine, and received the pathology back, and the pathology showed only a microscopic focus of cancer in one part of the tissue that they removed. And they removed 41 lymph nodes, all of which were negative for cancer, which is really just an amazing response to chemotherapy. So I am extremely grateful that it's all working so well. So I'm just 6 weeks post-op, and I recently saw my oncologist for a surgical follow-up and just to see, you know, what the next steps are. And I had a scan, and everything looks to be pretty stable at this point. So he talked about two different options of either restarting chemotherapy or taking a watch and wait method where, you know, we just take 2 or 3 months at a time and see what happens, because colon cancer is very slow growing. So within 2 or 3 months, it could grow, but it's not going to grow a huge amount. I opted for the watch and wait method because chemotherapy is really hard on the tissue in your body. In order to hopefully aim towards being cured, or as cured as I can be, the cancer needs to be surgically removed from my lungs also. By staying off of chemo for a few more months, I'm hoping to be eligible to have small parts of my lungs taken out where the tumors are, so that that part can be gone. And then at some point, I'll have to do chemotherapy again, because there's microscopic cancer cells that'll probably be floating around in my blood or my lymph system. But right now, I'm just living the life and enjoying a couple months off. And I have almost every weekend from now until my next scan planned, because I'm just so excited to be able to be off of chemo and able to do lots of things.
I think I said at the beginning of the prompt that you had to put your life on hold because of a cancer diagnosis. I don't think that's true. I think you're still doing a lot of stuff. You haven't really put anything really on hold. I just saw on your Facebook, you just recently ran a 5K like this past weekend. Is that correct?
Well, I walked it. Doctor's orders, no running 6 weeks after surgery. But there's only one, they call it an undie run in Northern California, and it's put on by Colon Cancer Alliance, which is an amazing nonprofit foundation that is working to raise awareness about colon cancer, increase screenings, and to support people who have been diagnosed with colon cancer. So when I found out when their event was, I emailed the organizers and I said, well, I'm not sure if I'll make it because it's only 5 weeks after my surgery, but I'm going to do my best. I went and I had, I think, 37 friends and family who went with me. We all walked the 3 miles together. It was great. So I plan next year to be there and to run it.
I feel like dealing with cancer and running actually have a lot in common in that no one's trying to compete with you, right? You're just, everyone's there to kind of beat the course.
Yes.
Yeah. So I guess the question is, what's the takeaway here for our listeners?
Well, the main thing for everyone to do, whether or not you're a cancer patient, is to start talking about your poop, which is kind of a funny thing to say, but it's a bodily function. You know, we have doctors who we go to talk about our menstrual cycles, and we talk about all kinds of other bodily functions, breathing and your heartbeat and all kinds of things. But in a general physical, I don't ever remember being asked about what my bowel movements were like. Had I known that mine were not typical, my cancer may have been caught earlier. It's just not something that my family ever really talked about, and I never had a doctor ask me, and I don't know how I would have known otherwise. So I think it's important to not be embarrassed to talk about that part of everyone's body and to start paying attention to what our bowel movements are like and to talk to your doctor about them. If you are having symptoms, which a symptom is even like not having regular bowel movements, say people who have irregular or different time of day or darker colors or lighter colors, all kinds of things, to talk to their doctor about it, because those are all symptoms. And your doctor will either order a fecal test for you, which is called a FIT test, or they have other types too, or they'll order a colonoscopy. And then the last thing that everyone should be doing is to talk to their parents. What people don't realize is that polyps, which a lot of people have on their colonoscopies, are how colon cancer gets started, right? So when I started having abdominal pain, my doctor said, do you have a family history of colon cancer? And I said, no, because none of my parents had colon cancer. But what I didn't know is that my parents had both had precancerous polyps removed during a colonoscopy. So had those polyps not been removed, they would have developed into cancer. That constitutes a family history, even though it had not developed into colon cancer. So it's very important to be informed and to talk to people about, you know, or talk to your doctor about what your bowel habits are. And then for people who have someone in their life who has cancer, just to be there, be close to them, be available for them, be a support system for them, but make sure that you see them as a whole person and not a host for the cancer.
I know my wife wishes I was more embarrassed about talking about poop. Like, I made her go get me a squatty potty, like, at the Target. So.
Oh, good! See, I like the squatty potty is sort of destigmatizing talking about poop. And my kids are not embarrassed at all. And we've made a point to even tell their teachers that our kids are not to be embarrassed about it, because now my kids are at a higher risk for developing colon cancer. So we don't want them to ever be embarrassed to talk about it.
Just to repeat what you said, just be comfortable talking about poop and treat people like the way you want to be treated, I suppose. The golden rule.
Yes.
Okay, that sounds great. I want to thank you for all the time that you've taken, and we're running on almost like 2 hours. Are you ready for the speed round?
Yes.
Marvel or DC?
Marvel, because it's Disney.
Would you rather win the Super Bowl or a gold medal from the Olympics?
Gold medal.
What sport would you want to get the gold medal in?
Marathon.
If you could have one candy for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Reese's.
Reese's Pieces or just regular Reese's?
Like the peanut butter cups.
If you could only do one exercise for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Running.
What's one thing people should be doing right now but aren't?
Talking about their poop and getting colonoscopies.
Well, that's the show for today. Thank you for joining us on the Intelligent Millennials podcast. You can learn more about Jessica and her story on her Twitter and Instagram accounts at TenaciousJess. If you're interested in learning more about colorectal cancer, please visit the Colorectal Cancer Alliance located at ccalliance.org. There you can learn all about colorectal cancer, how you can get screened, and how you can support the cause. You can even rent a giant inflatable colon for corporate events in order to raise awareness. You gotta check it out, if nothing else but to see what a giant inflatable colon looks like. Again, that's at ccalliance.org. All links, including the National Park Service and how fourth graders can get annual passes, will be available in the show notes. And as an additional note, the actual quote I had in mind was, "Don't pray for easy lives, pray to be stronger men." It was indeed uttered by JFK. Of course, he wasn't the only one to say that. Similar quotes have been attributed to other figures, including a 19th century bishop named Phillips Brooks, and even Bruce Lee. Please remember to rate and review the show wherever you get your podcasts in order to help others find our show. And as always, stay intelligent.